Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am one of your hosts for today, Ursula Rudenberg, and I'm here with my co-host, Susan Franson, and Kay Puttock. Hello, Susan.
Hello, Ursula, and hello, Kay.
Hello, everybody.
We're welcoming Kay back from New Zealand, and we'll be talking with her after we hear about the weather.
Okay, Kay has been gone for how long were you gone, Kay?
It was 7 weeks, I think.
Well, welcome back. How does it feel to be back?
I'm getting used to it. It takes some adjusting.
A little bit of culture shock from New Zealand. Well, let's hear more about that later. But Susan, why don't you give us the weather first?
Well, it's not nice weather to come home to. The rains are starting right on cue with the beginning of April. It will be mostly cloudy today with some chance of rain or even thunderstorms early evening. The rain is likely tonight and more thunderstorms are possible. Then rain is likely to continue on to Thursday, mostly in the afternoon. And the temperatures are dropping to freezing, so we can expect freezing rain, but the report said, don't worry, not much ice accumulation. Then on Friday, there'll be a 50% chance of precipitation, including a chance of snow again. On Sunday and Monday, there'll be 30% chance of rain, but by Monday, the sun should be starting to come out again, and on Tuesday, we're expecting partly sunny and 52 degrees. We have to go into the future to get a decent weather report.
Well, thank you, Susan. And using the phenology calendar, which tracks notable events in the natural world, let's check in with the mammals. We've been focusing on birds recently, and stuff is going on in the mammal world. On the March 18th, the minks began breeding. This is all according to the phenology calendar. We haven't actually seen proof of this, but we'll take their word for it. On the 19th, the moles began breeding, and coyote pups left their dens on the 21st of March. So they're really ahead of the game. And on the 27th, the beavers made their scent mounds. So what is a beaver scent mound? I looked it up, and as scent mounds are small piles of mud, sticks, and grass about a foot high, and beavers make them and use them to leave their scent on them to mark their territory, so they're kind of like border structures. And by the way, beavers are our largest mammals, growing up to 4 feet long and can weigh up to 60 pounds, so size of a small child, or a large child. They are, of course, known for the dams they build and streams where they live, and their ability... No, they're imperative to cut down trees. Beavers are nocturnal, and what's really interesting is that they can swim underwater because their eyelids are clear.
Well, I noticed that you said they were our largest mammals, but they're our largest rodents, and that's a lot scarier to think about a beaver as a giant rat. But there's some news of creatures that you actually can watch because the Decora eagles have 3 eggs that are expected to hatch any day now. If you check in on them and you are lucky, you can get a glimpse of the big eggs. The Decora eagles are the eagle couple that raises generations of babies in their nest outside a fish hatchery in Decora, Iowa. And a webcam has been attached to the tree next to their nest, so it is possible to watch them online day and night. It's really something to see these powerful birds up close this way. The URL is ustream.tv/Decora Eagles. DecoraEagles. Or just Google Decora Eagles and you will find the webcam.
And again, Decora is spelled DecoraH. And I was checking in on the eagles this morning, and one really beautiful thing to do is, you know, at night the webcam is an infrared light. So everything is black and white. So when you look at the eagles at night, it's like a black and white image. And then right around this time, right around 7 o'clock in the morning, the sun starts to rise. And so the image slowly turns from a black and white image into a color image. And it literally just kind of does it by degrees. And it's a really beautiful thing to watch. It's a very delicate kind of image. So anyway, Kay, you and Roxanne produce KHOI's monthly community service appreciation series. So can you tell us whom you're going to be covering this month?
Yes. With the community service appreciation series, KHOI helps get out the word about the work of one of our nonprofit community service organizations each month with interview features here on Local Talk and by airing public service announcements throughout the day about them. This month we'll be featuring Access. Roxanne Thompson interviewed Access while I've been out of town. Let's listen to the first one they recorded.
Listening to Community Service Appreciation on KHOI FM Radio. This program features agencies and organizations that provide valuable services to our community members. This is Roxanne Thompson, and I am your host for today's show. Our program today recognizes the Assault Care Center Extending Shelter and Support, or ACCESS. ACCESS provides a 24-hour crisis hotline and shelter for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault, and serves Boone, Greene, Marshall, Story, and Tama counties. We will be speaking with Angie Schreck, the Executive Director of ACCESS. Welcome, Angie. Thanks for being with me today.
Thanks for having me.
Angie, can you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you happen to be the Executive Director of the Assault Care Center Extending Shelter and Support, or ACCESS?
Sure. I've been with ACCESS for just a little over 10 years and done quite a few roles within my time there, youth advocacy, sexual assault advocacy, and eventually moving into more administrative roles. I've been the director since December 2012.
Sounds like you have lots of really good experience, so we're very fortunate to have you in that position. Thanks, Angie.
Thank you.
How long has ACCESS been serving our community?
Story County, based on what I can kind of understand from history, has been served in some form or another since 1974. ACCESS began as a sexual assault-specific crisis center based largely out of the ISU community with many volunteers. And then in the early 80s, it expanded to be a shelter facility.
Okay.
And somewhere in between there, I know that it incorporated both domestic violence and sexual assault.
Angie, will you share with us how domestic violence is defined?
I think oftentimes the community wants to see or is used to hearing of domestic violence as a physical act, a hit, a punch. And that's definitely true. But I definitely would like the community to look at it more broadly. And one easy way to remember what domestic violence is by remembering three P's. The first P being partner. So there's a partnership, there's an intimate relationship. It could be spouse, it could be dating. There's power. So that's the second P. Somebody holds the power in that relationship. It is not shared power. Somebody dictates the rules and expectations. And then there's a pattern. So it's not a one-time incident. There are relationships where you have, you know, one time where something crossed the line or something was difficult. But this is something that's ongoing. That person holds that power over the other individual on a regular basis. It's something that they can expect to happen within that relationship.
Has the frequency of domestic violence in our society changed over the years?
Not that I recognize, and not that many statistics recognize. The fluctuations in maybe the number of cases that come forward are typically related to how comfortable a person is coming forward about domestic violence. And then also related to that, how much attention is being paid to that issue. If it is dismissed in court systems, if it's dismissed by a neighbor or a clergy member or a friend, then that person's not going to come forward. So in my experience, maybe when we've been able to focus more on teen dating violence, we're going to see more teens being willing to come forward because they realize that they're going to get that help they need.
Do you have any thoughts about how the state of Iowa or Story County is in regard to being willing to address domestic violence so people are more willing to come forward or not?
Yeah. I would say generally we've had great relationships and great success in getting this issue addressed very seriously in our law enforcement, legal, and court systems. But there's always variations. There's always different perceptions that come into play when a professional is responding. Mm-hmm. So I guess I have to be honest and say that there's always work to do.
Okay.
We can have more coordinated efforts going on. We need to have people setting aside judgments. Victims are not always the easiest people to work with
mm-hmm.
because the trauma causes them to sometimes have behaviors that are difficult to manage.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the most challenging thing I see in systems is that sometimes systems want that victim then to go away.
Right.
And the easiest way to make that victim go away is to dismiss or to not pay attention to the report that's in front of them.
Could you tell us a little bit about the services that Access provides to our community and its members?
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, we serve 5 counties from Greene, Boone, Story, Marshall, and over to Tama. And we have 3 service programs that we're providing throughout, or at least available to folks within all of those areas. One is shelter. That's based here in Story County. It's available to individuals who are able to relocate and come to Story County. Our shelter program houses 18 individuals at any one time. And really, to be eligible for shelter, someone needs to be experiencing a high enough safety need in order to need to relocate and flee from that violence. It's both domestic violence and sexual assault,
mm-hmm.
And other forms. Sometimes trafficking is involved with sheltering as well. Our sexual assault services program is crisis intervention services. Maybe somebody reports a sexual assault and goes to the hospital. We're going to respond on site. We're going to make sure that they have that immediate counseling option, immediate advocacy to make sure that they're getting all of their rights upheld and all of their needs met. And it's also then ongoing supportive services for somebody who may have been assaulted years ago who decides to come mm-hmm. forward. We have no expectation that they come to us in a certain manner or that they go through a certain number of steps once they have come to us. If they decide that talking to law enforcement is part of their plan, that's great. If they want nothing to do with reporting what's happened to them within the system, mm-hmm. that's absolutely okay as well. Also, I want to mention within the sexual assault services, we have a number of prevention efforts going on. We have one staff member who is working specifically with males, reaching out to them and helping them understand what it's like to be a male engaged in the fight against sexual assault. Males have a lot of different mixed messages coming to them about what it means to be masculine, what sexual assault means to them, to their partner, to their loved one. Lastly, domestic violence services, similar structure as the sexual assault services. We have crisis response, ongoing counseling services. We do a lot of work within the court systems for domestic violence services. Individuals may be getting protective orders.
Mm-hmm.
They may be going through a custody hearing or a divorce hearing, and we're there to support them in that process. And then we're also in the community educating about issues of domestic violence to youth, to adults, really to anybody that has a chance to listen and wants to learn.
Are you able to provide housing to children of victims?
If children are with their parent, we can have them come into our shelter. Another thing we focus on with housing is shelter could be an option, but we could also help an individual find that next safe place.
Okay.
We can help with transportation if they decide to leave and go to another community.
Mm-hmm.
We can help them with applications for different housing programs, different financial assistance programs. Oftentimes, sheltering isn't the only option, and in many cases, it isn't the best option.
Right.
If somebody can get into their next safe apartment, or if they can go live with a sister or a relative and be safe and away from that abuser, that might be the most supportive environment for them.
Angie, are there any costs for any of the services and supports that you provide to the individual?
There's absolutely no cost for any service. Even if an individual was able to pay, we don't want to put that barrier in place, and we want to make sure that all people can access our services. In addition, there's absolute confidentiality, or at least an extremely high level of confidentiality. And so if somebody is worried about their neighbor knowing that they were served by us,
right,
or the police finding out that they were served by us, we make sure that we're treating those protections very seriously so that somebody can kind of just get past any barrier to make sure that they know services can help them. our shelter facility, we definitely work hard not to make it known. We also, you know, don't necessarily want to make it known that we're meeting with individuals on an outreach basis.
Right.
We might go to a public location to meet with somebody, but we're not going to wear access on our shirt. We're not going to have access on our vehicle when we show up. If people choose to never tell anybody that they've used our services, they should be able to keep that very private throughout the process.
I agree. That's great. Angie, do you have any situations that you can share with our listeners where you see that Access is truly making a difference in the lives of those who have experienced domestic violence?
Yeah, I mean, there are many, many stories. One story, though, that I have been given permission to highlight pieces of, I won't share the name, but I think definitely demonstrates what we're able to do is a mother last year reached out to us through a school system, and she had actually been separated from her abuser for a number of years, but was still dealing with exchanges and communication between the two people because of the shared child. And she hadn't realized that Access was available to her because she had been out of the relationship for a while. Oftentimes, I do think that there's that idea that I have to be in that immediate crisis stage in order to reach out for help. So when she realized that she could get ongoing support for herself, ongoing support for her child, it really helped in this case for her and her child to communicate about some longstanding issues that they were kind of maybe just brushing aside, and it helped kind of just open up that way for them to connect on a different level. I wanted to highlight that story, like I said, because we can work with individuals who are at any stage of their healing, and we encourage victims or friends of victims to contact us if we can be of help in any way.
Angie, does Access have volunteer opportunities for community members to become involved with your organization to show our support for your important work?
Absolutely. We conduct 3 volunteer trainings a year, one basically in the spring, in the fall, in the middle of the winter, and that allows us to train, on average, 30 volunteers at a time to be direct service providers. They can assist in our shelter facility, they can answer our crisis line, they can accompany an advocate to a court hearing or a medical response. In addition, we have multiple volunteers throughout the year that come and do indirect service projects. They may help us with yard work at the shelter facility. They may help us distribute flyers around the community about an upcoming event. So we welcome volunteers who have any level of interest to give us a call.
Great. Do you have an idea of how many individuals you serve each year?
Individuals served, and this is kind of the known individuals.
Right.
We have a lot of people that reach out to us anonymously. Average is about 800 a year that are served in the capacity of crisis intervention or counseling services.
Wow.
Beyond that, the number of individuals we serve with education reaches or exceeds 5,000.
Wow.
So we're really in a lot of different areas of the community spreading the word about issues of violence.
Well, that's awesome, and the number of direct service recipients indicates the need and the importance of your agency in our community. Great. How can community members reach us?
We have a few different options. I would encourage anybody to visit our website. We have a lot of very up-to-date information on our website, including all of our crisis lines. We have 3 separate crisis lines. That is www.assaultcarecenter.org. Or someone can call our business line, and at that line you can get connected to any one of our specific programs. You can get information about crisis services. Our business line is 292-0500.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, I think that concludes our formal interview, Angie. Thank you so much for being with us and sharing all the wonderful things and very important services and supports that Access provides to our community and how our community members can become involved with Access to show our support.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for listening.
You have been listening to Community Service Appreciation on KHOI FM Radio. Today we have been recognizing Access, an organization that provides a 24-hour crisis hotline and shelter for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. We have been speaking with Angie Schreck, Executive Director of Access. For more information, go to the Access website at www.assaultcarecenter.org or call 515-292-0500. Music for this program included The Crossing by the Menahan Street Band from their album The Crossing. Your comments and suggestions regarding Community Service Appreciation or any other KHOI broadcast are welcome. Please send your comments to khoiradio@gmail.com. If you enjoyed the program, please tell your friends. Thank you for listening. Until next time, keep your ears tuned to KHOI Community Radio.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. We just heard an interview with Angie Schreck from Access. KHOI reporter Roxanne Thompson spoke with her.
Kay, you mentioned earlier that you just came back from New Zealand, and you came back, what, 3 days ago?
Actually, it was a week now.
A week. So you were gone for about 2 months, right?
Yeah, almost, yeah.
So it's great to have you back. And how was New Zealand?
Well, I wasn't just in New Zealand. First of all, we took 3 weeks to get there on the Queen Elizabeth, actually, the new Queen Elizabeth. Then we were in Australia, and then finally New Zealand, and we spent 2 weeks in New Zealand. And I was extremely impressed with New Zealand. And that's what I want to talk about today.
Okay, please tell us a little bit about it.
Well, and most people know it's a very varied and spectacular landscape. You know, it was in the Lord of the Rings films because of its spectacular qualities. It's incredibly varied, ecologically diverse, and so on. It's formed by the collision of two tectonic plates. So there's these mountains and, as I say, very varied landscape. There's lots of geothermal activity, you know, like Yellowstone. And one really interesting place I went to, actually, it's like a thermal village. In other words, it's like Yellowstone with bubbling pools, but a Maori community actually lives there. And they don't try to use the geothermal to heat their houses or anything, but they do bathe in it. They have communal bathing. It's part of their ritual. And they cook food in it. And it's, so that's very interesting. But my introduction to how careful New Zealand is about their ecology, I had a rather rude awakening to that. I got in trouble with biosecurity.
Biosecurity?
Well, it's just as they check, you know, to make sure you're not taking firearms or dangerous weapons onto a plane, they check that you're not bringing things that might damage their, you know, seeds or anything like that into New Zealand. And you can't bring any kind of food. You can't bring a sandwich or a packed lunch from the plane or anything. Well, I happen to have an apple in my book bag, which I had completely forgotten about. And when they checked my bags as I came off the plane, when I was waiting for my bags to come out of the other, one of them was missing. And I was, where's my bag? And there was this sort of customs type guy, this security guy, sort of beckoning me with an unhappy look on his face. Well, to cut a long story short, I was fined $400 for that apple.
For one apple?
Mm-hmm. Expensive apple, that was.
So they didn't just tell you had to or throw it away?
No. They threw it away, but I was in big trouble. They really want people to remember not to bring apples.
So they're being very, very careful.
Indeed, yes.
And why? Why?
I've never actually understood, you know, why a ham sandwich or... I mean, I can understand live plants, but I suppose the apple's got seeds in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it might introduce varieties that they don't want.
For vegetables, fruits and vegetables, they have that at California. I once went into California with some dried fruits I had bought at a fair or something for the trip, but quite a lot and quite expensive. And they confiscated them and threw them away.
But they didn't charge you $400.
It seems like if they charge you $400, you should at least be able to eat the apple.
Well, one would think so, wouldn't
it? Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about New Zealand.
Well, the really sort of interesting thing about it is that there's no native mammals there except bats, which flew there. Because New Zealand broke from the original, I guess it was called Gondwara, the original landmass from which all the continents separated from, before mammals had evolved. which meant that things like birds became the top mammal, but not the top mammals, became the top, we're having troubles with mammals today.
Top species.
Yeah, top species. Yeah, like beavers are not the largest mammals, they're the largest rodents and so on. But anyway, so everyone knows about kiwis, which are flightless birds, but there was this huge bird, which is much, it was about 12 feet tall, an extinct bird called a moa. You know, it grew to this enormous size because it was, as I say, the top species and no predators to be afraid of. And it was absolutely flightless. It didn't even have, you can tell by this, you know, the fossil skeletons, didn't even have any vestigial wings or this big breastbone that most birds have. And also all sorts of plants and animals developed. There's still a prehistoric plant there. This should have been the same for 400. I mean, it looks like any other plant to me. Just a little leafy. But it was one of the first plants to produce leaves. And that's 400 million years old.
Wow.
One of the really lovely things we did was went to Stewart Island, which is an island off the west coast of South Island. They call it, actually, sometimes New Zealand's third island. And it's a beautiful bird sanctuary. You can hear birds singing all the time. It's just lovely. You have the windows. We had a sort of big deck outside our hotel room. Mm-hmm. Have it open and you just hear, it's just a cacophony of, or a symphony, perhaps I should say, of birds. And you see albatrosses on the boat going over and so on. Mm-hmm. And there's these wonderful birds called bell birds, which are, you hear these much more than you see them. Another thing we did was went over to another island from a very small, and the whole island is a sanctuary. It's called Ulva Island, after Ulva Island in Scotland, although it's much bigger, actually, than the Scottish Ulva Island, which is very, very small. And they have managed to exclude all these imported mammals that are dangerous to the New Zealand ecology, particularly rats, and, of course, rabbits, deer, stoats, and the big, big sort of... monster species, you might say, in New Zealand is possums, which is especially, it's an Australian possum. They look a lot cuter, actually, than our possums. They're dark furred, but they are absolutely very dangerous in dangerous to the ecology in New Zealand because they eat such a huge amount of plant life. And on this island, for example, there's these wonderful trees that grow in New Zealand called kauri trees, K-A-U-R-I. And these can live more than 2,000 years.
Wow.
And they grow about 160 feet high. There is now a kauri tree. I mean, of course, a lot of them were used for shipbuilding. The Maoris used to use them to make their canoes. But there does exist one still that's 1,500 years old. They're absolutely incredible trees. But they take a long time. They're in a very long time. They're in a seedling form, you know, about less than a foot high, very small. And if there were deer and things, they'd just browse them off, of course, and they'd never get a chance to develop. But especially on an island like this, there's nothing that interferes with them. They do have to keep a constant watch because rats are very good at sort of hitching rides in people's luggage and so on. And they keep them even on clean boats. And they can also hitch rides on seaweed and things like that. So they do have traps, they're baited traps, in case rats make it to the island. But that is a complete sanctuary, and so that's very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So that was about it. The kauri trees, the moa birds, and there's all sorts of wonderful birds, actually. Parrots, which are they seem almost tame because, you know, they hang around parking lots, that kind of thing. And
you mentioned a few times Maori. Is that the indigenous?
Yes, the Maori people, yeah.
And did you still see Maori people?
Oh, yes, sure. In fact, that's one of the big things for tourists, is doing cultural shows and showing the traditional dances and so on.
Mm-hmm.
We went to this village, as I mentioned already, the thermal village, where they live there amongst the hot, bubbling mud pots and whatnot. And, you know, and they showed us a place where they swim in I mean, it's communal bathing with no clothes, but the women wear a towel around them.
Mm-hmm.
And they just roll it up from the bottom as they walk into the water. But their whole family goes in, and it's mixed bathing, although they take their clothes off in separate areas. And they showed us where they cook their food and so on. But there's another village where they introduce you to what it would have been like to to be a tribe that was visiting them in the old days. And there's all these elaborate rituals that they go through, and then they feed you when you get inside and mm-hmm. so on. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there's this famous, it's called the Haka, a sort of, I suppose you'd call it a war dance, that they did to intimidate people. And they also use it as a greeting to show that, you know, we're not to be messed with. You might be friendly. But and it's used, rugby football, their mm-hmm. team, as a sort of, the All Blacks, their team is called, because they wear black uniforms. They do this haka at the beginning of the...
As a business. Challenge
yeah,
to the other.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, New Zealand is right next to Australia, right?
Pretty close, yeah.
And, of course, with Australia, we associate the kangaroo very strongly with Australia, but they don't have kangaroos in New Zealand?
No. No,
so it's a completely different ecosystem.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting. Oh, I should mention that there's an extinct eagle, too, called the Hust eagle. And we're not actually completely sure why this great bird, the moa, became extinct. It was partly human. The Maori certainly used to eat it. But it was also the Hust eagle, which is an extinct eagle, got to be very large, and it used to prey on the moa.
Oh, really?
So,
wow. So that's a big bird.
Yeah. Yeah, well, when they've got no competition and no predators, they get bigger and bigger and bigger, and then uh-huh. at a certain point they become too big if there's any competition or any predation. Or
right.
Anything.
Well,
this eagle got very big too. It was a huge eagle.
The human species does not like big animals.
No.
That will eat it.
No, but also it does like big animals that it can eat, like big flightless birds and so uh-huh. on.
Yeah.
But anyway, this eagle got very large, too, and the eagle was partly responsible for probably the extinction of the moa.
Uh-huh. Well, very, very interesting. It sounds like a real amazing exposure to a whole ecosystem that
yeah, it was
very
wonderful.
Beautiful.
Yeah, and it was so peaceful on these islands with little bays, you know. And of course, the whole population of New Zealand is very low, very little unemployment and so on.
Mm-hmm.
If I was younger, I'd probably immigrate there. Susan, I understand there was an Echo Fair here in Ames this weekend, and you went to it?
Yes, I did, on Saturday, and it was so much fun. I wanted to recreate the feeling, because I went around with my little field recorder, and I want to tell you what I heard and what I saw. The first thing that I saw as I walked up on this beautiful, warm Saturday was the solar car. For 25 years, ISU has been developing and racing a solar car. And this one looked like a great big table full of solar panels, huge, with a little bubble in the middle. And before I could talk to anybody, they dismantled it and took it inside so you could see the interior, what's under the hood, so to speak, which actually turned out to be like a big suitcase underneath full of batteries, and mm-hmm. with ISU students to explain it all to you. And I taped quite a bit of that. Unfortunately, there was some background noise, and these racers talk fast. So I'm playing just little bits to give you the feel. The person that I will be playing for you is Dakota Morgan, who's been involved in the team that drove across the country. Well, you'll hear where he drove in races. And he's also has been involved in the developing of the, I think, the materials and the building of the design of the cars. And so we'll hear just a little snippet from him as he describes the course of last year's race and something about this year's race.
Top 5 or 10 teams usually are able to do highway speed for a good period of time. Hyperion here, for example, if we have a nice sunny day like today, we can go literally from the time the sun rises to the time it sets, going nearly that highway speed. On the race, we will usually have a 2-hour period in the morning and night to charge the cells, and so we'll have the car up on stands like it is right now, and that way we can get that direct sunlight for 2 hours in the morning and night. And so we'll be driving from, I think, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. And on the American Solar Challenge race in 2012, we were actually able to go that entire time when it was a nice sunny day anyway, going full highway speed, so 55, 65 miles an hour.
Well, he also mentions that this year, the race course, which will go from
Austin, Texas, to St. Paul. We'll pass through Ames in July. I think it's the 26th of July, so something to be watching for. Last year, they went from New York to St. Paul, and they had something in front of and behind them because, of course, they're only a few feet off the ground. I mean, they're like sitting in very, very close to the highway, literally. So it's interesting to visualize, and they have a wonderful website, which I'll mention later. The second one tells what it feels like to drive this car.
What does it feel like to be going along so close to the ground?
That's one of the more fun parts. It's if you've ever driven a go-kart, it's very similar to that. There's no differential like in your big modern cars. There's minimal shocks for the bounciness of the road. And so a lot of the highways are pretty nice. There are some in Iowa that are fairly bumpy, of course. But overall, it's very much like driving a go-kart. It's very warm, very loud, and very fun because you're driving so low to the ground, and it feels like you're driving about twice as fast as you actually are.
And the last little bit that I have is when I asked him about safety, have you ever had any accidents?
Now, have there been some spectacular crashes or not?
Not really, actually. The races have been pretty good. For Iowa State, at least, the only really bad crash we ever had was when I think our sixth car, maybe, one of the rear tires got caught in an expansion joint on a bridge and ripped that off. And the driver got a sprained ankle.
Sprained ankle. Worst the thing that happened to him.
This is Local Talk, and we're discussing the Eco Fair, which was held by the City of Ames at the Ames Community Center in the City Hall building last weekend. An Eco Fair features local sustainable businesses, service programs and organizations, and recreation. And it began as an energy fair, but has now become larger and more general Eco Fair. So, Susan, that was pretty impressive what the guy was saying about the car. And do they have a website that shows what this looks like?
Yes, they do. And it is Solar Car, SolarCar, .stuorg, .iastate.edu. And you'll get that link on our website after this program is finished.
So what else did you see at the Eco Fair?
Well, the next thing I saw was the bag monster. The bag monster was walking around every place all day. And so let's hear his description of himself.
A man just approached. Are you a man? You're a bag man?
Actually, I'm a bag monster.
A bag monster. And what's your costume made of?
Plastic bags, sweatshirt, and sweatpants.
And well, you don't see much of the sweatshirt and sweatpants. You really do look like a monster. Is it hot?
Yes.
You look fluffy.
Yes, I do. It's a nice costume.
Oh, yeah. Well, but how many bags do you have there, do you know?
Somewhere between 500 and 1,000 plastic bags, probably.
Okay, and so what is the message of the bag monster?
Essentially, what we're trying to say is that we want to reduce the plastic waste that we are using every day. So this is more or less to try and gather, if you were to gather up a lot of the plastic names, there'd probably be around, right now, probably around 5 bag monsters walking around. But bags don't get up and walk on themselves, so.
Then they need you, right?
Yeah.
Do you want to identify yourself, or are you an anonymous bag monster?
My name is Cameron McCaw, and I'm with the Reducing Plastic Movement.
And what is the Reducing Plastic Movement doing?
We're actually trying to meet with the city council, and we actually talked to the mayor about reducing or putting a fee on plastic bags. If we can, it would be putting a ban on it, but that's like a very, very high goal, but putting a fee would just be great with us.
And what kind of a fee would you ask for?
Somewhere where you would pay enough so that it would basically clean up itself. So every time you buy a plastic bag, it would put a fee on it. Therefore, you could pay for the, instead of putting the taxes on everyday people so that you have to pay the EPA for subsidies, it's essentially just paying for itself. So instead of putting the hidden costs into your taxes, you're just putting the hidden costs not so hidden anymore.
And just down a little way from where I saw the bag monster, there was the organization that he's working with, which is Ames High Students.
And I'm now in front of the booth for Ames High School. And so can you tell me what you're doing at Ames High?
With Ames High School students, and we are in environmental science class, and we decided for our project we wanted to reduce plastic waste. And we see that plastic bags are probably something that's very easy to reduce because they're rather unnecessary. And so we've been working with people around the city, and we're going to be contacting businesses, trying to get them to reduce plastic bags. And we also are interested in the city placing either a ban or a fee on plastic bags as a means to reduce their use.
Thank you. And so what's your name?
Evan Culver.
Thank you. And?
Tivemba Masumi.
And did you get involved in this through a class or is it a club?
It was a class thing. And the reason why we chose this is because we saw a documentary called The Baggett Movie in class, and we got passionate over the movie, and we wanted to get together, and we wanted to place a ban or fee on plastic bags, because plastic bags are somehow ending up in our ocean, hurting animals, because when animals get entangled in them in the ocean, they try and digest them, and they can't because it's not food that they should be eating, you know, they can't digest it naturally. And so then they get internal infections. And in the end, that infects us, because when we consume ocean life, such as salmon, we'll get infected if they're infected as well. They get entangled in plastic bags.
And I earlier talked to the bag monster. Is the bag monster connected with you?
Yeah.
Is this part of your project, the outreach?
Yep. It took 4 hours to make that costume.
Okay, I can believe it.
There was one more thing that was designed especially with students in mind, and that's what I saw at the next table.
So I'm standing by a booth that says Iowa Climate Prize, win $5,000, see info below. And so I can pick up the info. Is there a website where people can look for this?
Yeah, there is a website. It's a relatively long website, but it's actually pretty easy to remember. Just iowaclimateprize.org. So all three words put together, spelled out fully, .org. And you can go to the webpage and you can find out more about what the prize is about. But basically it amounts to that there's a group of people here in Iowa that have collected $5,000 and will give it out to anybody. It doesn't have to be in Iowa. We can give it out to anybody that puts together a 2-minute YouTube video. And they don't submit it to YouTube directly. They have to submit it to us. And we vet it for somewhat technical correctness. We have some experts from Iowa State, DMAC, and University of Iowa, and Drake that are climatologists. And they will vet it to make sure that it's at least halfway accurate. And then we release that to YouTube starting April 8th. And then whoever who gets the most hits gets $5,000. No questions asked. So it's actually a pretty easy process. We foresee that maybe a younger group of people that would apply to this prize, but it's open to anybody, any ages, and you can submit any time after April 8th. It just means that's when we start the clock, and it'll run for approximately 3 months, and then everyone who gets the most hits, and if anybody's interested in help sponsoring it to fund the $5,000, that would be great as well. And there's directions on our webpage of how to get money to us and get us get our collection together for the $5,000 prize.
Well, that sounds pretty inspiring. Is that all we need to know?
Well, that's probably pretty much it. You just need to know where to go to submit the web the video and look at the rules. You know, we don't want to have anything in there that's controversial or anything that would be offensive to anybody. So pretty much just common sense about what the video needs to look like. The videos we've seen so far are actually been pretty impressive. So, but again, we haven't released anything yet. That'll happen on April 8th.
Well, that's coming right up.
Yep. So again, you can submit any time after that. That just doesn't mean that the door closes in terms of applying for the competition or submitting a video. That just means that's when the race starts. So anybody can join the race at any time.
But, of course, those who start first have a little head start.
Well, we were talking about this. There could actually be some advantages, you know, if there would be a major event that would catch the media, that would prompt people to Google climate change. If you were to submit your video on that day, that actually may be an added advantage as well. So there may not be any big advantage of being on the April 8th. There could be other advantages, other dates could be critical as well.
So we'll be watching you.
Great.
Bye. Bye.
One thing that I liked about the fair was that they had a lot of things that were really nice for children. Not necessarily ecological, like face painting and popcorn, but the popcorn was made in something that looked like an old-fashioned popcorn maker, but they explained what electricity-saving devices were in there to make your popcorn. But they had something that looked like a dollhouse display that would be lit up for electrical dangers, electrical hazards to educate people, and they had a bicycle that you could pedal and light up light bulbs. So the children who came along had a good time. And as well as talking to the bag monster. And they also had a big teardrop that was the water drop, who was kind of the mascot of the event. And they had children in some of the commercial exhibits, because when I came out from talking to the bag monster and the climate prize people, there were many, many tables and booths for all kinds of energy-saving things. But the one that everybody pointed me to, and they said, you've got to go there, is Goats on the Go. I'll play a bit with my interview with the two young boys who were manning this booth.
First, introduce yourselves, please.
I'm Sam Steele.
And I'm Jack Steele.
What is Goats on the Go?
We take goats to a property and they eat weeds, invasive species of weeds and thorns, poison ivy, a lot of stuff
that people don't want on their property.
Yeah.
And it's usually just stuff that people would like to get rid of, but we do it without using chemicals or machines.
Where did the idea for this come from?
We live on a farm, and we didn't have any animals at first, so I don't know how he got the idea, but it's fun to have.
Is it a business?
Yeah, it is.
So if you had a list out here on your computer screen, what were some of the things you have there that we can get rid of with goats?
Thorns, poison ivy, wild mustard weed, multifloral rose.
So you'd think those goats would get sick.
I don't know how exactly, but there's just something that they don't get sick if they eat this stuff. It doesn't hurt them. Thorns don't hurt them at all, and so it's really interesting.
So how did your dad get this idea?
We had a kind of a pasture that we didn't really have any idea what to do with it, and my dad had seen ideas before of guys in Colorado doing kind of the same thing, so he just thought, well, let's get some goats and maybe we could do something like this.
So do you have a website?
Yes, we do.
Goatsonthego.com.
Okay. Well, anything else you'd like to say that I haven't asked you about?
Well, last year at the Eco Fair, we brought some kids, baby goats here, and that was fun, and a lot of people liked that. This year they were born too late, so we couldn't bring them.
Did they answer all your questions okay?
I think they did.
You got it covered? All right.
You must be the dad who got the idea for the goats.
Well, yeah, I'm one of the founders of the business, yeah.
Okay. And what's your name?
Aaron Steele.
And where's your farm?
Northeast of Ames.
And how much land do you have?
We just have a relatively small acreage. But that's part of what gave us the idea for this business, is we wanted to be able to graze our goats on the kind of vegetation they would prefer, and so we decided to start moving them around.
So everybody else is helping you feed your goats, right?
Well, that's right, yeah.
And paying for the privilege.
They are. They're paying for that, and they're paying for a lot of service from us, too.
She traveled here not long ago, straight from the great unknown. And being from that land of dreams, she seems to glow. She has a lovely two-tooth smile. She's just barely 2 feet high, and words are still beyond her reach. She can't speak, but every day she'll say to you, the world is new. And you'll look and you'll see it's true, the world is all brand new. She points at birdies in the sky, waves at people passing by, and nearly everything she sees, she tries to eat. She makes you wanna sing a silly tune and dance a jig around the room. And when she giggles in your ear, you'll hear your heart laugh too. And she'll say to you, the world is new. And you'll look and you'll see it's true.
Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and we've been hearing interviews from the Ames Echo Fair last Saturday.
Our guests today have been Dakota Morgan from the Team PRISM at ISU, David Gruwell, Ames Climate Prize, and Sam Jack and Aaron Steele from Goats on the Go, and Roxanne Thompson spoke with Angie Schreck from Access. Your host today have been Ursula Rudenberg, Susan Franzen, and Kay Paddock.
Local Talk is engineered by Rebecca Brown, and music you heard today included Brand New by Peter Mayer from a CD, Heaven Below. Peter performed in Ames last weekend. And our theme song, as usual, is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org, where you'll find an archive of all of the Local Talk shows we've produced since we went on the air in 2012. Recent shows will be posted on our homepage as soon as our webmaster, Ron Carson, can get the information from us. There you'll find lists of our guests and links to the organizations and other resources that we have mentioned on our shows.
If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends and consider becoming one of the 500 families, donating $20 per month or $250 per year to help us meet our operating expenses, though we'd appreciate anything that fits into your budget. We'd also like to hear your feedback, either by phone at 515-292-2878 or by email at khoiradio@gmail.com with news in the subject line.
And remember that on April 19th will be our grand opening for our studio, so mark the date and plan to join us here at the Pantorium at 6 o'clock on the evening, April 19th.
Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you'd like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878 or at the email khoiradio@gmail.com. Your participation as audience is making KHOI possible. Thank you for listening and see you again on the radio.